latest edition of my podcast, Chief Energy Officer, Time to Lead, a space for reflection, renewal, and inspiration, and for the real stories behind leaders committed to lead from and with the human heart. And today is frankly a bit of a dream come true. And maybe this conversation couldn't be more timely, because today's guest is someone who leads not only with competence and experience, but the way I see it, with purpose and heart and deep compassion, and who I believe sees love as the very source of leadership and not some romantic luxury. Jennifer Furch is the Chief Operating Officer of NBC Camps, an organization committed to developing athletes both on and off the court, as you say, and I love that. And that has impacted tens of thousands of young people through sports, integrating athletic excellence with personal growth. And more importantly, behind her title is a much deeper story, one of legacy, of love and action, and of commitment to healing and empowerment. Jennifer is also the daughter of Fred Crowell, the founder of NBC Camps and a pioneer in faith-based athletic coaching, and author of the beautiful book, Words of Hope. We also have the great fortune of a mutual friend and mentor, Paul Nakai, who connected us. I think it's fair to say that without Paul, this conversation wouldn't be happening. And I suspect that's no coincidence, too. So I bow to Paul in this moment. And Jennifer also wrote one of the most moving reflections for the very first edition of my book, Chief Energy Officer. And I just had to quote this at the beginning because it's so beautiful. You wrote, "The prescient understanding of individual as well as collective need for the application of forgiveness, foresight, deep care, and mindfulness provides necessary wisdom for today's compassionate leader." Jennifer, whilst we've never met in person, I'm grateful you're in my life and taking time for this conversation, Time for Leadership. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you. I am so grateful you're in my life, and I'm thankful for the beautiful book that you wrote. I do think it's incredibly important, especially in this time of uncertainty and leadership that couldn't be farther from what's being described in that paragraph. And so I just thank you for your commitment to well-being, growth, healing, forgiveness, and joy.
Oh, thank you. And I sometimes wish that this was not only an audio call so that people could see that beautiful library that you're in. I couldn't Yes. imagine a more beautiful and meaningful surrounding. And actually, when I asked you, I sent you an email and asked if you would be willing to record a podcast together, you immediately said, yes. There was not, yes, I would feel honored. And I think maybe to get us started, the question I wanted to ask you is, what is it that you actually said yes to? What is it you said yes to? And if this podcast could become a gift for some listeners, what would you like to give and to pass on?
I love that question. I believe that there's people that change us for the better. And my father and Paul Nakai were part of that journey for me. And without their wisdom, I wouldn't be who I am. I don't think that we could be as effective as a company without their stories, their important messages in our life. And I love that you are a listener, that you devote yourself to mentorship and to being, I think that there's a real requirement to humility, to surrender to someone else's voice in your life. And that is listening. Listening means to obey in Hebrew. And I think that that's so important, to have the discipline to allow another person to say, I see this in you. I'm recommending this, you know. And Paul was so gifted in that. He was never didactic in his recommendations. He's inclusive. He is moving us through question, through discovery, through mutual discovery. And so I could see that in you when you're writing that book that's so important about energy, how it changes a dynamic, how important it is for leaders to recognize and become students of energy. It's been a profound teaching, and I'm just very, so it was an emphatic yes, simply mm-hmm. from the fact that you are speaking something that I think is so importantly vital to our world. And that would be the gift, if people could grasp some of these profound teachings about how do we live in a space of love and wisdom? How do we live from gratitude in adversity? Gratitude in adversity is such a transformational understanding if people could grasp that themselves and not live reactively, but into moving intuition into a space of peace when it isn't easy. So those are a lot of the gifts that Paul gave our family, and that I got to witness my father living out in the present, which was a gift.
Well, I bow to that. And if I think of Paul, and he might be hearing this too, I can't recall, it's just as you said, I can't recall a moment when he was teaching me anything. Mm-hmm. And he was therefore teaching so much.
He was,
And he had this, he didn't hesitate a second over the years we've been talking to tell me, here is what I see in you again and again. And it moves me when I even say that. Mm. And actually, I was thinking of your father too, because you mentioned him. And I was thinking of our conversation. I couldn't help to think of the Ted Lasso series. Do you know?
Yes.
And it's one of my favorite series of all times. And in the very first season, Ted enters the locker rooms of the football club he's invited to lead. He's yes. taken a deep breath and says, I love locker rooms. They smell potential. and I was thinking of both your father and you. Jennifer, can you take us back to the beginning? So to the spark and share your father's initial vision of NBC Camps and the potential that he smelled, to speak in Ted's words.
Yes. So my dad, I need to back up. So my dad was a very competitive person, a very competitive athlete. And he became one of the youngest Division I coaches. So in the USA, we have different divisions for sports. And he was the highest division at the youngest age. I think he's the youngest in history. He was incredibly competitive, and he really was heartless in the sense people called him stone face. Like, he rarely laughed. He didn't cry. His mom died of cancer when he was 21, and he made a vow that he would never cry and he would never pray again. And so he made that commitment, just that I'm going to be a machine in many ways. And he was married to my mother, and she had a very transformative experience. And he reimagined faith again and, you know, coming back to heart, coming back to tears, coming back to love as a centerpiece rather than ambition or, you know, this mechanistic drive to success. And through that whole journey, he decided to quit college coaching, and he moved into a program that went into universities to bring diversity onto college campuses that were segregated. So LSU, Louisiana State University, was historically they were really very, very militant in their viewpoint about race and race division. And my dad was bringing teams that were racially unified onto courts to bring this message of awareness. And you know, they would call him up and threaten him and saying, if you bring any person of color onto this court, we cannot guarantee your safety. And, you know, he would bring everybody and he would speak directly to the audience and they would speak about the importance of racial reconciliation and healing and that segregation is wrong. Slavery is needs to be recognized and acknowledged as an evil from our country. And that was a really seminal piece of his life, you know, that part. Well, during that time, I became very ill. I was a new child, a baby, 1 to 2 years old, new in the world, full of joy. And I started getting ill, and they thought it was the travel schedule because these were exhibition teams. So some of the top colleges in basketball would have these teams come onto the court, and that's where he would be coaching and bringing this message. And they thought the travel schedule was too much. So he gave that up for me, which I feel so tender, you know, that was so tender of him. And we moved to the home place where my mom kind of grew up, and my dad started counseling people. He had a master's in so he started seeing couples and marriages and families, really giving them insightful practice on how do you reconcile with each other? How do you create an environment of love? How do you create dynamic relationships that both people say is life-changing? You know, I think as parents, we really care for our children. We want to have a great relationship with them. And it's interesting that 70% of parents would say they don't like their relationship with their child, you know, as far as communication style. They rate their communication style with their kids is not satisfactory, and kids as well with their parents. They would say 70% are saying, I don't like the conversations I'm having with my parent. My dad was super interested in that. Like, what is going on? And so he imagined, how do you create a space where we can talk about these things, how to love parents, how to forgive, how to do all these things? Well, most kids are not going to want to sign up for something like that, but they do want to understand how to be better at sports. And so that's how the passion was formed, is seeing the need and connecting the two interests. So how do you help people really become the best they can be? And that really was the catalyst for his vision of a space, an environment where people are allowed to ask questions, to consider, to wrestle, and ask, how could I be my best? And it's a beautiful thing to do and be a part of. And I think that you in your book about energy, you sense how important creating spaces for that powerful energy to be transformative is, how laying that foundation. I'd love to hear more your point of view on creating spaces for energy to arrive. That is that healing, transformative energy that is so powerful.
Thank you so much for sharing that story and you know, stepping back for a moment. I understand it better now. And what I love about it is that you realize that these life-transforming moments when the world looks differently, when you see something you couldn't see, when a connection has healed, because we're born, on the one hand, we're all born healthy. And at the same time, we're born into a wounded world. It doesn't take long for a child to see the hurt, to see the things that don't add up. And you know, you talked about segregation. When I see three-year-olds, there's instant friendship. They see each other, and it doesn't matter how they look like. I said, hey, my buddy, you need to learn hatred. You need to learn separation. And we learn it relatively quickly. So what I love about what your father has done is that it's not about separating that. Let's meet in a place and talk about forgiving. Let's do it right here.
Yes.
In whatever you care about, you know, be that cooking or be that sport. And I think that begins with conversations being allowed. Here it can be heard. It can be said, right? It is what it is, what it is, what it is, what it is. And if I have enough space in me, because I do my inner work, then mm-hmm. I can hold that. I think that would be one perspective on this. And I was just wondering, as you were saying, well, I was a little girl and then I grew up, you know, in this environment. Do you remember a moment, maybe early on, when you personally felt like, I can see this is not about sports, or it's more than sports. This is changing lives. This is about learning forgiveness. This is love in action. Was there a moment that you recall where you felt like, now I know where I belong in this?
There's so many stories. It's hitting my mind right now, but I'm going to share one that I think is one that I take with me all the time. I hope I don't cry too much on it. My dad was such a powerfully, deeply loving man. He loved so deeply and would learn everyone's name at camp and just really cared. And he created a home that I think was very unique. My brother and I could say, Dad, that's frustrating us. And he would be like, thank you so much. Tell me more. And it was never, it's not this permissive parenting where the parent was weak and did whatever the child wanted. He would not cave on things that were obviously integral to our well-being, but he was incredibly moldable and flexible and adjustable, especially as a powerful man. And I think that was incredibly insightful. So this story was probably the most seminal in my life. And that was, my dad, again, was very intense. He wanted things to be excellent. He didn't want us to produce something that was mediocre. He wanted it to be full-hearted and fully giving. And we were all in this group. There was about 40 of us coaches sitting in a circle. And my dad could err sometimes on intensity. You know, that was one of his... he could err on intensity. We all have our places that we move into, you know, danger zone. And I could tell he was ramping up. He was getting kind of fired up. And this girl said something, and he was sharp with her. And I said, Dad, I think you're getting a little too intense, which I could have done better. You know, that wasn't the best way to handle that. And he said, I'm talking right now, or something sharp. And I didn't like the tone of it. I didn't like how the meeting was going. And right after it was over, I walked up to him and I said, Dad, I feel like we didn't have a great interaction in front of everyone. And I didn't like how that tonality went down. And he could have said, Jennifer, you interrupted me. You didn't handle that well. He could have had a lot of things to say about my character in that, because I didn't handle it well either, I would say. And he said, Jennifer, thank you so much for letting me know that. I love you so much. Thank you. I could see how my intensity got the better of me. And would you please forgive me for an... Will you please? Sorry, just one second.
Yeah, I feel it too.
Will you please forgive me for not being the leader you needed in that moment, and for letting my ego interfere? I love you, and I ask your forgiveness. And then Boris, he went and he found every single person. They were scattered over all the campus. He went up to them individually and he said, would you please forgive me for the way I acted in the meeting, that I made ego more important than love? Would you please forgive me for being a leader in that regard? I want you to know that I want to ask forgiveness for my tone and for how I acted at that meeting. Everyone is, you know, here's the head of the company asking forgiveness of every single person in that meeting, finding them, you know. And it's, I think that was incredibly telling to me how when you have an opportunity as a person who has power to humble themselves and ask forgiveness, so much changes. And it's, I think of that all the time. in my role of being willing when someone says something to be willing to ask forgiveness.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that. The fact that you share that reminds me of why I wanted to do these podcasts.
Mm.
So that these stories that convey truth and power can be heard by more people, because they touch me right now and might be true for others. And you're going straight to probably one of the most transformative, how shall I call it, agents, which is forgiveness, which is probably the most transformative place. My friend Azim Kamisha said, forgiveness, that's where preparation and grace meet. You know, on the one hand, you can prepare for it. You can make a deliberate choice that is based on understanding. But then it's something that you just receive. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we associate it. I'm so glad you're bringing in this in a conversation on leadership. Often we associate it with very big things, murder and major crimes. When actually, when imperfect human beings that are so perfectly unperfect meet.
Yes, totally.
we're constantly wounding ourselves, and we're constantly in touch with the things that are still wounded.
Yes.
When your father was talking from, I rated ego more importantly, another way of saying that might be, I was in touch with a thing that still felt like something needed to be defended. So that thing that isn't soft yet he could notice it and transform that and bring that into the moment. And I would say there are many of these moments every day. I can see it in our family. I can see it in our business. How beautiful.
Yes, absolutely. I think we talked a lot about this as a family growing up, the importance of a language of repair. How do we navigate the things that we do without bringing shame, defensiveness? You know, we live in this modern age of incredible research coming out of relationality with the Gottman research out of University of Washington. And, you know, what causes us to double down, to be contemptuous, to criticize, to be defensive. And my dad blew all of that out of the water and just immediately said, we want a language of repair to be able to clean each room at the end of the day so that there's nothing between us, that forgiveness becomes more like a little hand vac rather than these excavation, you know, people wait until the house is just absolutely beyond repair and they have to try to see if they want to redeem it. And of course, relationships become so weighty that way because there's so much in between the two hearts of trying to speak. There's so much suffering and pain that hasn't been resolved each and every day. And so it's a storehouse of bitterness.
How should I ask this? If you build on your father's legacy, and that has, you know, obviously, and we could go in length the way you lead on a daily basis, on good days and not good days, right? When you're at your best and when you're not, and when you're repairing. What do you feel most responsible for today when it comes to carrying forward what he once began?
That's a beautiful question. I feel that love is at the centerpiece of everything that we want to do, and how easily that can be, I think, impact versus intent. I think everyone has the intent to be loving and joyful and create spaces. I mean, most people who aspire, they want their home to be a loving, joyful, peaceful place. They want their child to enjoy that experience mostly. And I think in the home, in the business world as well, I think we want to assume that we're creating places for people to thrive. And I think intent really requires us to settle in and understand impact. And impact requires listening. It requires checking in. And my dad did that so well. He would often say, how do you think I'm doing as a dad with you? Do you feel like I'm listening enough? Do you feel like our conversations are moving in a positive, energetic way? And, you know, recently with my older daughters, as they're moving into adulthood, they've come to me and said, Mom, our conversations are, you know, you're asking questions that we feel, irritated by. You're asking questions that seem fear-based. And I said, thank you so much for that, because I really want to have, my goal is not to defend myself and to have to protect. I'm a great mother. I'm a great worker. I'm a great leader. And laying that all aside and leaning into listening deeply, meeting with each person, what do you need from me? How can I serve you better? How can I create a more healing environment? What does love look like in this case? How can we come to closer to center? And I think shame is a real detractor from that. And shame and pride, they both, ego, I would say, or narcissism. And coming to that centerpiece of love, listening, grace, slowing down, listening more, and providing places to learn together, I would say. That's the joy that I have in my role, is how can we learn together? How can we grow together? What are we listening for in our serving of our communities? What do our communities need? And that takes a lot of time of just going out onto the courts, into the classrooms, into people's spaces, and just paying attention. I think love is attention.
Yeah, and I have this beautiful quote somewhere. I can't recall who it's from, but love is the quality of attention we bring to things. Mm-hmm. Well, and you just said slow down. So why don't we slow down on love for a moment? Funnily, I have this little post-it note here in front of my desk. And for our listeners, it says slow down. I sometimes put that in front of me just to remind myself. And so if we slow down on love, you know, it's a word we rarely hear in leadership podcasts, and yet it seems to be at the core of what you're focusing on and coming from. I sometimes refer to, in the book as well, the human operating system as kind of the sum of all our filters and blind spots, the sum of our autopilots, you mentioned to some, the sources and blockages of our energy. But it looks like the way you frame it is that love is kind of the source code of that operating system. Mm-hmm. And you also talk about impact. Can you share a story, so not an idea, but a lived moment where you saw that source code in action, where love changed the trajectory of a person, a decision, a department, where you saw it having an impact? Because I think there were many people who say, well, come on, let's focus on outcomes, and love is when we have a good day.
Yeah, love is when we have a good day. I'm going to tell a story of a young man, because I feel like this story is really insightful, how important love is to all aspects of it is the wellspring. And I think businesses get that wrong. They think of efficiency metrics. You know, there's so much data driven information, the science of the situation, and everything becomes very mind-driven instead of heart-driven. And the heart is at the centerpiece of everything that we do. When the heart gets blocked, and I think the research is really fascinating right now, that the mind is actually being more spoken to from the heart than the mind speaking to the heart. And I would say a lot of corporate America is missing this piece, that love is at the center, heart is at the center, because it is our passion. It is what we want to do and what we want to thrive and achieve. You know, there was a young boy that was playing, and he's an incredible player. And my dad recognized his talent right away. And he was watching him play. And no one, I don't think, who doesn't pay attention as a coach who really can understand. He looked like a great player. Everyone was noticing how talented he was. My dad spent some time a little bit afterward with him, and he said, can I spend a little time with you? And he said, sure. He said, you are an incredibly gifted player. You do these things really well. I noticed something. And he said, yes. And he said, I noticed that you have some hurt in your life. And the young man started to cry a little. And he said, yes, I hate my dad. And my dad said, I see that in you. And I see that sorrow in you. And that began a journey of friendship with them that, you know, my dad in many ways became a second dad to him and really gave him his name. he was married in my dad's house, he and his wife. And just that noticing, that recognizing, that sorrow, that loss of not having a good father, and then recognizing the need and filling that need. And I think that's what each person is coming to an organization. And before we can really serve and give 100% of ourselves, those things that block us, whether it's loss or bitterness or that deep sorrow that we aren't able to address, just like Paul says, when we're living in unhappiness or trouble, we're going to project that into the world. And we're going to project that the truth that is in us out into the world. Just, I loved what you said earlier about, you know, when we were together before this began, that our thoughts inform us where we are at, and our emotions are a barometer of that thinking, of that being. And when the emotions, I think that our corporate world discounts emotion. It discounts the power of emotion. It's our most incredible ways to engage and live in this world. It's life-changing when we can touch into the emotion. But we often move towards mechanism and mechanistic ways of the heartless. And it's easier. It's easier because the heart is a messy place in many ways. Yeah. When we step into the heart of people. And I think it takes a tremendous amount of listening and insight and time and paying attention. But that's where the healing lies. That's where the transformation lies, as you can see. That's where the energy lies.
Every word that you say speaks to me, both in the sense of if it is about bringing all of our energy to the table,
yes,
then
exactly.
Paying attention to where that energy is blocked, where it's stuck, where it can't flow, then that becomes a leadership job, paying attention to that.
Yes, exactly.
Azim used to say, when you're hooked by resentment and bitterness, you can't bring all of you to the table. It's
exactly
a responsibility.
Right.
The other thing that you're pointing to is that there seems to be you said it beautifully, it's easier. We seem to look at businesses merely as a complicated problem. So it's complicated. So we look at what is visible and solve it with tools for complication. And some things are just complicated. They just need thorough thought.
Yes.
However, as soon as human beings come to the table, things become complex. There are things we can't see. They're interdependent. There are things that are under the surface. And my sense is we're lacking the practice of working with that human complexity where I don't know and I need to be okay with not knowing. So your father was probing and saying, hey, I'm sensing something. I could be entirely wrong. And he touched it and said, all right, shall we talk about this? Not knowing there is no immediate solution to it. There is not a thing to do. It's a very different kind of leading. And I'm not saying that we should exchange the one for the other, but become more, you said it so beautifully, wholehearted, right? Leaders, rather than half-hearted. And I'm wondering, so we often associate, because I think what you're also pointing to is courage. This is not an easy conversation that your father began. We often associate love only with softness, with gentleness. Have you also ever experienced love as a kind of fierce clarity, a love that also says no, that sets boundaries, that holds accountability?
Yes, absolutely. One of my favorite quotes from Martin Luther King Jr. is, love without power is anemic and weak. And I think we all sense that. That's not true love. If I'm permissive, I allow whatever, there is no boundary, there is no pursuit of excellence, there is no need for courage, that's not true love. Love at its very center is requiring us to come to a better truth, a better honesty, authenticity together, heart to heart. And that requires work. It requires surrender, and it requires fortification. It requires both and. You know, I love what Paul always is saying. It's not either or. It's the and. And I think the bifurcation again is a cheater's way for the ease of things. But love costs all we are. It's one of my favorite quotes from Maya Angelou. She says, "Love costs everything that we are, and it demands of us, but it's that liberation." I should give you some of her lines. She says, "We unaccustomed to courage." Isn't that incredible? First line, "We're unaccustomed to courage, exiles from the light, live coiled in shells of loneliness. Until love leaves its high holy temple to come into our sight to liberate us into life." Love arrives, and in its train comes ecstasies. Ancient memories of pleasure, ancient histories of pain. Yet if we are bold, love strikes the chains from around our souls. We are weaned from our timidity. In the flesh of love's light, we dare be brave. And suddenly we see love costs all we are and will ever be. Yet it's only love that sets us free. And I think the cost of love, you know, we have to feel. And I think if you've been overwhelmed, especially as a child with feelings, I think it comes back to that choice of mechanism, you know, that mechanistic choice to be a machine or to be a human being, to face those emotions that are really, really hard. And to navigate that with discernment, with insight. Love is not weak. Love is not power. Love is a combination of both power and humility, which isn't demonstrated very often. It would be wonderful if we had so many, if our leaders could be like my father, that we could see this in action. Wow, incredible. Like yourself, like Paul and Nikai. Those visible, you know, paragons of how to do this, how to live it full-heartedly with power and love and humility. Yeah.
Thank you for bringing all that in here. I almost feel I'm leaving a bit of space for it so that it can resonate. And I think the key is, and that's fundamentally, I think, the work we're doing when we're focusing on what is then called leadership development is in the second half of life to look into all that we bring to the table, the hurt parts, the wounded parts, the healthy parts that can hold that. And as soon as I begin seeing that not as a problem, but the actual gateway, I think that's what she was pointing to, right? That It's very, very, very uncomfortable. And often we're, and that might be one of the reasons why we perhaps so much focus on the complicated part of business, the intellectual part, because one way of not feeling is to go into the head. That is a place where it can be very safe and I do not have to feel. And another way of not feeling is to accelerate, to be fast, you know, hence why you pointed to slowing down. I sometimes feel that when I'm with leaders and we just slow down, let's just take a few breaths seriously. And it's just one question. It doesn't take long to be in touch with the real question that wants to be asked in that moment. And sometimes, even in a normal meeting, just quieting down and bringing in the question of, you know, what is present for me right now? What am I sensing? What am I afraid to say? And by asking, so creating the space for the possibility for it to be said and held. Like I'm feeling insecure. I actually don't know what to do right now. I was talking to a CEO during COVID times, and I said, "How are you doing?" And he said, "Well, you know, we're kind of planning month by month right now, not a year or one and a half." And so I was with my team and said, "That's my and with our stakeholders and said, "That's how far I can look. After that, I don't know. Are you with me?" And they said, "Yeah, sure, sure." And he shared with me, "I'm so glad because it has always been that way. I just wasn't allowed to say it. I couldn't look far beyond the month, right? A little bit.
Yes.
But then there are so many things. It is chaotic and it is complex. Can love be learned?
Absolutely. I feel my dad had to learn it. He had a terrible father. An absolutely terrible father, one of the worst. And he became an incredible father to me. And he was a student. I mean, his life, he was a student of love. He was a student studying, working on it every moment of his life. He never claimed to be an expert of loving, though I would say he was the most loving person I've ever met.
I would say so too.
He was constantly, like Paul describes, he was the novice, seeking, learning, working, evaluating. How can I love better? How can I love more deeply? How can I love more truly?
Let's just imagine for a moment, right? Let's imagine everybody who's got a leadership responsibility. And I don't mean only organizations with that, right?
For sure.
There's so many leadership roles formally. Imagine what would be possible if everybody committed to becoming a student of love. What planet would that be?
Heaven, probably.
Probably. That's the definition of it. And if we, you know, so often the world seems to forget about love. I mean, we see division rather than connection, fear rather than inspiration, threat and cruelty more than compassion, bitterness and resentment more than forgiveness. And yet there is this deeper system, this source code beneath it all that we might call love. So I'm just wondering if you feel that tension too, you know, between the manifestations of the absence of love or disconnection from it. It's always there and we might just be disconnected. Yes. How do you stay connected with that deeper current without closing your own heart in day-to-day business when, you know, you need to write a P&L too, right? And take decisions and sometimes under speed and, what are a few things that you have learned that worked for you to to maybe not stay connected, but maybe reconnect and reconnect and reconnect, if that makes sense.
I would say there's so many of those decisional moments, and I think decision is a super interesting word. It means something has to die. And when I also believe in big-hearted, loving choices. What is the most loving choice can I make in this moment? Even if it's a hard choice, I'm going to say, what is the most loving choice? And those are really painful. We are partnered with a sister company during COVID. You know, they immediately, my colleague on the other end, he's my, in essence, boss as well, called and said, I need you to cut 1/3 of your employees right now. And I said, you know, I need a little time to digest this and see what we need to do. And I'm not going to cut people. These are my, you know, the people that I need. They count on me for employment. They have children. They have livelihoods. They are thriving. And I'm not going to make a decision financially that I don't believe in that. I don't believe in that. I know that we have to hit numbers and bottom line, and I understand that 1/3 of the money needs to be cut, but I'm not going to do it through cutting that person. And so I called him back and I said, I'm going to get you your, if I get you your revenue, if I cut what's needed for the safety and security of the business bottom line, are you good with that regardless of my methodology? And he said, yes, as long as you bring in the numbers, I'm okay with that. And he gave me freedom to do that. And then I had the choice of, you know, how is this going to work? And we met as a team and we figured it out, and everyone committed to a certain reduction, some more than others. And we were able to retain everyone through that slowing down and listening in a really tough situation and saying, okay, what is the most loving thing we can do in the most difficult time? You know, this difficult crisis where we're going to have to make some serious sacrifices. So I think that's always the choice I sit with.
I love this question. What a wonderful question to walk with as an invitation, as a North Star. What is the most loving choice I can make in this moment? And I think you're also pointing to the source of courage. And I often feel that the courage that it takes to do something, to decide when something needs to die. So after the decision, there is no point of return, right? And in the German language, the word Entscheidung means to take a sword out of its holding device. So after that, you've made a choice, right? It's divided. And I feel that courage is the result of knowing deep inside, you have my back.
Yes.
You know, when I say this, when I'm in this meeting and I try something and it won't work the way we both anticipated, I only have the courage to try that because I know you have my back. And that becomes a source later.
And I think, Boris, that triggers me with corporate America in the sense that if I am able to, with the stroke of my pen, cut people left and right, and there is it at some point you have no heart to do that. And so it comes down to, yes, people, there's hard decisions to be made. And I think I don't envy the people that have had to cut people and haven't had the freedom to be able to cut their salaries or cut other people's salaries in order to sustain the people. I get that. But at some point, there's a decisional choice whether I'm going to operate from the heart or not. And when we continue to kill the heart, that's the outcome is we live in the mind, we live in numbers, we live without relationality, we live in this space that that love can't be talked about or exist because we've killed it.
Yeah. And then we can't take decisions anymore because they're actually taken in the heart. That's where it starts. There's so many decisions that show that if you can't feel, you can't take decisions anymore, right?
Exactly.
I think feeling is the first form of thinking and not the second one, right?
Absolutely.
I think it shared it in one podcast that my brother, he's a long haul airplane pilot with a German company, and they're using that. So they have this policy of saying so and interviewing each other. What does the feeling say right now? What are you sensing, right?
Yes.
Or they can ground a plane if they have a feeling that something isn't right. That the mind kicks in so much later. But you talked about courage, and I'd love us to talk about courage in the current situation in the more broader sense. You know, you talked about leadership for you personally when you were a child, in your family, in your organization. And then this organization is embedded in a society and in a planet that is in movement right now. And it seems to me that the attitude, the language, the decisions taken by the current U.S. administration is not only very disconnected from everything that we've been talking about, but is rooted in anger, in threat, and fear much more than love. And younger people are seeing that as an example. It is also overtly attacking the very democratic and human foundations, the values that, and the partners that you and I are standing on. Even mentioning this on a podcast, you know, for the first time in my life feels threatening. So I'm wondering, in what ways sometimes we can feel so powerless that I am just ahead, you know, at the head of this organization or an employee in this small organization. In what ways do you feel that leaders can now cultivate and demonstrate courage to inspire positive change, even when the broader environment feels threatening and unstable? What's our role now?
It's more important than ever because we are in a time where the language immediately is divisive. You know, the language is immediately cruel. The leadership is cruel. The leadership is harming at the very highest level, and people are afraid. And when we are, as Paul talks about, when we're afraid, he gives us such a great metrics of evaluating words, threats, violence. This kind of rhetoric of either them and us, you know, that language already tells us that we're in trouble. We are in the bottom line.
The language itself,
The language itself is trouble. And how do we raise out of trouble? Well, it has to come back to forgiveness. We have a society that's incredibly embittered to the point that there is no love, there is no respect, there is no value for a person that has a different point of view. They're immediately labeled an enemy or a threat or someone not to be cared for. And I think at the very core of that is, you know, if you look at the world as words, what are the words being said on Twitter, on news, on things like that? Just the tonality of our news is to me at the very, if I would like to say, I would say the anchored news is at the very heart of this divisive language, for the point of profit. And I think we are really at the heart of trying to decide, are we for profit or are we for love and well-being? You know, even the word Christianity has become a tool for Christian nationalism, which is at the very heart related to the pocketbook and has nothing to do, in my mind, with the values of of Christianity of love and well-being and self washing the feet of other people. I mean, it has, you know, so our words have become lies, and they become untrustworthy. We can't, like you said, for love to exist, I have to believe that I can turn my back to you and I'm not going to get stabbed. I'm not going to, you are going to embrace me and I'm going to embrace you. That love, you know, and we're at the point where there is no love right now. There's no love in our language, in our news stations, in our rhetoric with one another, our town halls. It's not coming from the highest levels. It's a language of abuse. It's a language of violence. Yeah.
Thank you for being so clear about this and what you're saying, bringing the notion of courage and love together. I love the washing someone else's feet is so much more than just a metaphor. You know, I'm wondering if everybody picked just one person or said, "I will wash your feet." And really, it is a very powerful gesture. And if we choose to, you know, flood the zone, as they say, with love, with forgiveness, with tenderness, because words carry energy. They do. That's what they were made for. They're just small containers. There are other things that carry energy. But boy, do they carry energy.
Yes. For sure.
And maybe if we remind ourselves of how powerful it is, then in our direct zone of influence, we can influence a lot. And, for example, resist to even like or react to any posts that are divisive, even if they come from a positive intent, right? Even if they're coming actually from a good place, but they're not building bridges. I can relate to that. Thank you.
It is a challenging time because we need to address it, but I think our tools and methodology given to us are just they require time, they require face to face, they require touch and authenticity. You know, the media platforms that we have are just so anonymous and can be so heartless, and again, expediency without love is, I mean, we've seen it throughout history, how dangerous that is.
Absolutely.
I would love to see spaces where people can come together and talk about art and forgiveness and well-being, and that, you know, people from all different politics can meet together and see the humanity that's been lost.
And that is a practice, and forgiveness is probably at the very, very, very center of it. Rarely has it been needed so much. We're creating new wounds everywhere by the thousands, and they will stay for generations. So in a sense, and maybe it's not a coincidence that I talk about that in the book, probably forgiveness is a core leadership competence that we'll need to practice again and again. First of all, for ourselves, I had the opportunity to learn so much from Azim Kamisha, who forgave his son's killer and got him out of prison under parole two years ago after a 20-year battle. And he put forgiveness at the very, very, very center. And he was teaching in Lausanne about the role of forgiveness in leadership. And I think you're making a very poignant point why it's more important than ever. Jennifer, I'm just mindful of time, and I simply want to thank you for letting us into your heart, into your work of love, and letting us see the way you see with your eyes just a little bit. And reminders that love is not weakness, but maybe the very deepest form of strength. And I wanted to close by just asking you, if you had a magic wand and you could instantly change one single thing in the way we think about leadership, organizations, corporate culture, you name it, but that would make this world Better lad. How would you use the magic wand?
I would use it to have each leader lead from a place of love and forgiveness and be experts at being able not only to forgive the harm done, but be willing to voice and say, "Will you forgive me?" I think that would be incredible. Incredible changes that would happen.
Thank you. And I'm just thinking, if I mentioned, and I have it here on my desk, I was starting mentioning your father's book, maybe as a way to honor him. I love the title on it, Words of Hope.
Yes.
And the other day I was thinking, if there's one thing that leaders need to bring to the world right now is hope, because without yes. hope, well, we can all just stop. So what,
yes.
in the light of what we just shared and the environment that tells us almost the opposite, what words of hope would you love to offer to emerging leaders who aim to lead like you with their heart, but might sometimes be disheartened?
I think all of us have to decide how we're going to handle the painful news, the painful choices. And it is a daily decision. And I see, watching my dad die of cancer, he wrote words of hope as he was dying. And I think that that is a decision choice that we make every day. Yes, there's war. Yes, there is pain. And I'm going to love deeply. I'm going to ask forgiveness. It may not be for, it might be that small moment towards my husband, but that is a reverberating choice that builds and change it, that has that rippling effect. And to be that, to wake up, my dad would make that decision. Don't ask me how I feel when I have cancer. Ask me what's bringing me joy. Speak the hope now. Don't, move out of the rhetoric of, isn't it hard to have cancer? Isn't that a bummer? Are you feeling afraid? And move into the language of, you're a great father. What are you doing to bring joy to your grandchildren? And I think that that was one of the gifts that he said, is that hope is contagious, and speak into that hope, speak into that joy, be someone, walk into, find the joy, find the love, find that moment. Yes, there's painful things happening. We're not closing our minds to it, but we are going to flood the room with that infectious love. That's what we're going to do.
Jennifer, what a wonderful way of closing this. That actually does give me hope and joy, and we're both radiating. If I could hug you, I would.
Hugs to you as well.
Thank you so much, Jennifer.
Thank you. Thank you for living so heartfelt and for choosing that courage to live that way. I honor you and I bow to you as well. Blessings.